Okay, so I'm going to talk about neutrino factories. Let's see, is there a pointer? So, after some brief introductory material, I'll talk a little bit about the sine squared 2 phi to 1 free sensitivity, CP violation, and the pattern of neutrino masses at a neutrino factory. First of all, trying to give you an idea of how sensitive you might expect a neutrino factory to be. Reminding you about the challenge that we've already heard a lot about today, correlations and ambiguities, and then showing you, in the face of that challenge, how well we think we can do at measuring the parameters of interest at a neutrino factory. All of this is within the framework of free flavor mixing. We shouldn't forget that maybe that's not the whole story. And also, although neutrino oscillations provide the primary motivation for a neutrino factory, we shouldn't forget that there are other things that you can also do at a neutrino factory. Finally, if I have time, I'll tell you a little bit about neutrino factory R&D, the status of the R&D, and where that's going. So, I should remark at the beginning that neutrino factory R&D really is an international endeavor, and there's activities not only in the US, but also in Europe and Japan. In the US, it's pursued by a collaboration of 130 people, particle physicists and accelerator physicists and engineers from US labs, US universities, and even in this US activity, there's a very healthy international participation. So it is really quite an endeavor that's going on. Now, by this time, I think most of us believe that neutrinos oscillate. And within the framework of free flavor mixing, we believe we know something about the parameters that describe the oscillations. And we've seen these numbers from time to time during the course of this meeting. However, despite the information that we know, there's still a lot that we don't know. In particular, we don't know whether free flavor mixing is the whole story or not, or whether there are contributions from other things, some of which have also been discussed this week. We don't know, within the framework of free flavor mixing, we don't know whether this parameter sine squared 2 phi to 1 free is small or tiny or zero. We don't know the Dirac CP phase delta. Is there CP violation in the neutrino sector? We don't know the pattern of neutrino masses. What's the sign of delta m squared free 2? And we don't know whether sine squared 2 theta 2 free is maximal, or is it just very close to maximal? There's no guarantee, but we can hope that the answers to these questions may lead us towards some insight in understanding the origin of flavor. However, getting the answers to those questions is going to require the right tools. And a tool that has been discussed over the last few years, which is perhaps the tool of choice, is a neutrino factory. Now, a neutrino factory is essentially a muon storage ring. So this is a muon storage ring with long straight sections. So muons decaying in the straight section create an intense neutrino beam downstream of the straight section. Now, in order to create the muons for that storage ring, you need an accelerator complex. And this is what that accelerator complex consists of. You start with a very intense proton accelerator. You use the protons on a target to create as many pions as possible. And since you want to use the maximum number of pions, you collect them at low energies, a few hundred MeV, and you confine them in a high-filled solenoid, and you allow them to decay. So this is a decay channel. At the end of the decay channel, you have lots and lots of low-energy muons, but they occupy a very large phase space, both longitudinal and transverse phase space. So it's more a gas of muons than a beam. So the first thing you have to do is something called phase rotation, which is getting the energy spread of these muons under control. So at the end of a phase rotation system, you now have a narrower energy spread, sufficiently narrow that you can capture the muons in an RF system and create bunches. However, the transverse phase space is still very large. So after the phase rotation, the next system you need is a transverse cooling system. And this is an ionization cooling system. So here the idea is the muons pass through material. They lose momentum by dEdx losses, both longitudinal and transverse momentum. Then you replace the longitudinal momentum using RF cavities. And you do that many times, taking away the transverse degrees of freedom. So at the end of the cooling channel, the beam is sufficiently under control that you can put it in a normal sort of accelerator and accelerate it up to the muons to the energy of choice, which is normally considered to be somewhere in the range of 20 GeV or 50 GeV, with the lower energy preferred from a cost point of view, because acceleration is one of the cost drivers for the neutrino factory. And the studies that have been made have shown that you can design a system that can deliver 2 times 10 to the 20 muon decays per year in the straight section. Now, this concept first came into being at the end of 1997, and already there was an existing collaboration looking at this sort of muon source for muon colliders. So in 1999, the interest in neutrino factories had grown sufficiently that that collaboration shifted its emphasis from muon colliders to neutrino factories. And by the spring of 2000, already the first serious engineering design study had been completed. And this was about $1 million worth of engineering, so it was a significant study. And since it was the first study, some arbitrary technology choices had to be made. And at the end of the study, we convinced ourselves that yes, neutrino factories were feasible, but we failed in the intensity goal that that had been set by the physics needs by a factor of a few. However, we'd learnt by then our mistakes. In doing the study, we learnt what a better choice of set of technology choices would be. And so a year later, we'd completed a second generation study, another $1 million of engineering study, and we succeeded in this intensity goal. So 2 times 10 to the 20 muon decays per year. And the other thing that those studies did were really enable us to understand the R&D program, the hardware R&D program that would be needed. So that's the neutrino factory concept. And the beam you get downstream of these long straight sections, if you store positive muons in the storage ring, then the beam consists of 50% mu e's and 50% anti nu mu's. If you store mu minuses, then you get nu e bars and nu mu's. Since we understand muon decay kinematics extremely well, there are minimal systematic uncertainties on the spectrum of these neutrinos, on the flux, and very importantly on the comparison of neutrino and antineutrino results. But more important, this is going to be important in giving us the ability to make precision measurements. But most important of all for a neutrino factory is that we have nu e's as well as nu mu's in the beam. And the reason that's important is because it enables you to search for nu e to nu mu oscillations in a conventional neutrino beam. Because you start with an essentially pure muon neutrino beam, you can only search for nu mu to nu e oscillations. The advantage of searching for nu e to nu mu oscillations is that let's assume we store positive muons in the storage ring, then the nu e's oscillate to nu mu's. And when they interact in our detector by the charge-current interaction, they produce a muon of opposite charge to the charge of the muon stored in the ring, wrong sign muons. That experimental signature is extremely clean, much cleaner than trying to see nu e interactions producing electron appearance in your detector. And in fact, it's very straightforward to eliminate backgrounds down to the 10 to the minus 4 level with this signature. So that's really the hinge on which the power of a neutrino factory turns. Now, many groups have calculated signal rates and signal to background ratios for neutrino factories and also for superbeams. And I'm just going to show you the results from one group, because I'll show you some other results from this group, Lindner et al, later on. So Lindner et al defined four scenarios: an entry-level superbeam scenario, a high-performance superbeam scenario, so an upgraded JHF going to an upgraded super-K, a hyper-K detector; an entry-level neutrino factory scenario, so a watered-down version of the neutrino factory that I just showed you; and a high-performance neutrino factory scenario, i.e. the neutrino factory that I just showed you. And for these four scenarios, they've calculated signals and backgrounds for a certain set of oscillation parameters, where they've taken this critical parameter sine squared 2 theta 1 3 to be as large, so a very optimistic value, as large as you can set it given the Schur's limit. And you can look at the signal rates here. They're substantial for all of these scenarios, especially the high performance scenarios where you have tens of thousands of events. But the important thing is the background. And you see the advantage in going to a neutrino factory: the background, the signal over background, increases by almost approaching two orders of magnitude. Now, theta 1-3, we've seen, is the critical thing that we need to go for first in the future program. And it's worth remembering, when we think about the sensitivity for theta 1-3, that at least in some approximation, the oscillation probability of interest is proportional to sine squared 2 theta 1-3. And we already know that this is a small number, so these probabilities that we're trying to measure are going to be small. Smaller, certainly smaller than 10%, probably a lot smaller than 10%. In the absence of background or systematic uncertainties, and in a neutrino factory that's a good approximation, then the sensitivity essentially improves linearly with event statistics. So if you see a given scenario, provided you're in the region sine squared 2 theta 1-3 greater than some minimal value, which is going to be 10 to the minus 4 or so, then you want to know what happens to the reach if you increase the detector size or the running time or the beam intensity. Then in some approximation, it just increases linearly with those parameters. So just to give us a first feel for what sensitivity you might expect for sine squared 2 theta 1-3 as a neutrino factory, this shows you fixing delta M squared atmospheric. This is the minimum sine squared 2 theta 1-3, that value which corresponds to observing an oscillation signal at three standard deviations. So it's somehow the threshold sensitivity. And we find that for a neutrino factory, the answer how sensitive the minimum sine squared 2 theta 1-3 you probe depends on the delta M squared 2-1, the subleading delta M squared scale. So we have to plot it as a function of that. So in this region, for sine squared 2 theta 1-3 above 0.1, it's already excluded, so that gray region is excluded. High-performance superbeams should be able to cover something like this yellow band region. And neutrino factories can cover all the region above these curves. So this curve is for 20 GeV neutrino factory. There's 30 GeV, 40 GeV, and 50 GeV neutrino factory. And of course, we're really interested in the region between these two hatched regions. This is at least LMA region, LMA 1 from the Camier, from the current data. So if you notice, the thing to notice here is that, think of a 20 GeV neutrino factory. You can see that the minimum sine squared 2 theta 1-3 you have sensitivity for is going to be somewhere in the range of maybe 10 to the minus 4, maybe a little bit better. You're also sensitive to the subleading delta M squared scale. So looking at these figures, you might guess that you have some sensitivity of order 10 to the minus 4. If you want even more sensitivity, then maybe if you go up in energy, you can get even more sensitivity. So that's just a first sort of guess at what sensitivity you might get, and we will have to look at correlations and ambiguities before we can arrive at a more quantitative understanding. Now, of course, just seeing a signal and measuring phi to 1.3 is only the beginning of the story. We would like to go on and look for CP violation and determine the pattern of neutrino masses. And the way one does that is by looking for nu e to nu mu oscillations, measuring the probability for nu e to nu mu, and compare with nu e bar to nu mu bar. So measuring wrong psi muon rates when you store mu pluses in the storage ring, and then comparing it when you store mu minuses in the storage ring. If you go over very long baselines, then this you can create a difference between these two probabilities due to matter effects. So, and the change of these oscillation probabilities due to matter effects depends on the pattern of neutrino masses, which gives you a way of determining the pattern of neutrino masses, but then you have to separate out the effect due to matter from the effect due to CP. To give an idea how that works and how well you might expect it to do at a neutrino factory, plotted here is the ratio of number of events you get in a neutrino factory experiment for nu e bar to nu mu bar oscillations. So when you store mu minuses in the ring, compared with divided by the corresponding rate when you store mu pluses in the ring. And it's plotted as a function of the baseline length. So if your experiment is at zero baseline, then this ratio is a half, just reflecting the differences in the cross-section for antineutrinos to neutrinos. As you go to longer baselines, you either lie up here, if this is the pattern of neutrino masses, or down there, if this is the pattern of neutrino masses. The reason it's a band and not a curve is because what's varying in this band is the CP phase, the Dirac CP phase. And the statistical errors, these little black bars here, are the statistical errors that correspond to a five-year experiment. So you see that if you choose the baseline wisely, you can certainly tell which of these two bands that you're lying in. And the statistics are such that you could probably get away with an order of magnitude or even less statistics than quoted here. Or these results are for sine squared 2 phi to 1.3 of 0.004. So in other words, you could get away with this thing being an order of magnitude less or so than that value and still have sensitivity to these measurements. So your first guess looking at these plots are, if you choose the baseline wisely, you ought to be able to determine the pattern of neutrino masses and probe sine squared 2 phi to 1.3 values down to something like 10 to the minus 4 again. So that's just sort of a naive look at how well you might do, but we know life is more complicated. And we've seen expressions from time to time showing the relationship between the thing that you measure, which is the probability for nu mu to nu mu, or nu mu to nu e in a conventional beam oscillations, as a function of the parameters you're interested in extracting. And this is a leading order expression, so which is you expand the probability in terms of the two small quantities that you have to play with, the ratio of the delta m squareds and the small angle phi to 1.3. And then you just keep the leading order terms, and this is what you arrive at. The thing that you measure, this oscillation probability, you measure as a function of energy. So you're going to measure an energy-dependent probability. And then you're going to try to extract phi to 1.3, which appears all over this mess of expression, a mess of terms. You want to extract the sign of this delta parameter, which contains the sign of delta m32 squared, to determine the mass hierarchy. That also appears all over the mess, this mess of expressions. And you want to determine delta CP here. So this term is positive for neutrinos and negative for antineutrinos. So you can well imagine that if you're trying to fit this energy-dependent probability and extracting these quantities, that there are correlations between the parameters you're trying to extract, and there are also forced solutions, this eightfold ambiguity. So you have to be careful in your experimental strategy to be able to eliminate these correlations and the forced solutions. Fortunately, at a neutrino factory, there's a wealth of information you can throw at this problem to try to uniquely determine these parameters precisely. In fact, what you can do is you can divide the data sample up into an event sample tagged by right sign muons, one tagged by wrong sign muons, one tagged by an electromagnetic shower, either an electron or a positron, and if you don't determine the charge, that's just one sample. Positive tau leptons, negative tau leptons, or events with no lepton at all. And you can all do all of that with mu pluses stored in the ring or mu minuses stored in the ring. So there are 12 distributions you can simultaneously fit. Here's an example of four of those 12 distributions for some particular scenario. So here you have events tagged by an electron, a right sign muon, a wrong sign muon, or no lepton at all. This is the measured energy, the simulated measured energy distribution. The black histogram is in the absence of oscillations, and the other two histograms are for two particular sets of oscillation parameters. And the thing you notice is that these distributions are sensitive to the oscillation parameters. So you have 12 distributions to play at for each baseline you care to design an experiment for. So winning strategies then for fighting these correlations and ambiguities are, well, one thing you can do is you can combine neutrino factory data with high-performance superbeam data, and people have looked at that. You can use two neutrino factory baselines, so that certainly helps, as Kerry was saying earlier this morning, that certainly helps in resolving ambiguities and correlations. You can all use all of those distributions which I just listed, all 12 distributions, and in fact no group yet has attempted to do that, although certainly some of the distributions have been looked at. For instance, using nu eta nu tau turns out to be very powerful. Ultimately, you would like to do all of this, all of these things. So there have been studies that have looked at this, they've looked at this, they haven't looked at this completely, number three, but partially, and certainly haven't yet done all of the above. However, what has been done is already very encouraging, and probably the group to first show results, and they show results at Neutrino 2002, I guess a year ago now, is the Lindner et al. Group. This was the group, there are several groups now who have made these studies. This was perhaps the first group that had the tools put together to deal with these correlations and ambiguities with reasonable models of the systematics in the experiments and the detector response, the energy resolutions, and so on and so forth. And this was the first thing that they showed, which was for each of these four, the entry-level superbeam scenario, a high-performance superbeam scenario, an entry-level neutrino factory scenario, and a high-performance neutrino factory scenario, they show the sensitivity to sine squared 2 theta 1 3. This is at the 90% confidence level. And the way to read these plots is that in the absence of any systematic errors in the experiment, or any correlations or any degeneracy, the statistical precision that these experiments would have, you go to the leftmost part of this bar. So for a high-performance neutrino factory, it's a few times 10 to the minus 6 in sine squared 2 theta 1 3. The presence of unavoidable systematic uncertainties, like, for example, the uncertainty on the matter density profile in the Earth, uncertainties like that, costs you, and the price it costs you is this dark blue region. So it's a modest cost, not a factor of two. Then these correlations and degeneracies, if you don't do anything about them, they cost you a lot. That's the green and the yellow piece, orders of magnitude in sensitivity. However, the correlations and degeneracies you can fight by throwing more information at the problem. And this very same group, a few weeks later, showed one strategy you can use to change the picture significantly, and that is, supposing as a neutrino factor you go for a one very long baseline, then this is the picture you get, that instead of losing these orders of magnitude, you now lose maybe a factor of three or something, and the sensitivity is well below 10 to the minus 4 in sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi. Well, they're not. The correlations mean that these ellipses in parameter space are not circles. They're tilted, right? So there's correlations between the parameters, so the errors are correlated. The degeneracies mean that there are forced solutions, that there are additional solutions. But in fact, the amount of these bars, that are green and the yellow, is a little bit arbitrary because it depends on the order in which you try to resolve, you know, taking them into account. It's not, you do it the other way around, you probably get a different colouring scheme.
Do you actually know what they mean by the sensitivity? They're always confusing. It's like the degeneracy just means that you don't know what the other parameters are. But if the other parameters are something, then there's a well-defined sensitivity to sine squared 2 theta 1 3, even though you can't measure it very well. You're so sensitive to it. I don't really know what they mean by.
Yeah, it is a little bit confusing, and my understanding is that this is a 90% confidence level upper limit on, if you didn't see a signal, that's what you would be able to say.
Okay, so
given
this is
like that's my understanding. Now, that's just a sensitivity just for seeing a new mu, a new e to new mu signal, but actually what you really want to know is what's the smallest value of sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi for which you could do the full physics program. See a signal, determine the sine of delta m squared, and also be sensitive to maximal CP violation. And for the same group, they've considered strategies in which you have two detectors at one baseline, 3,000 kilometers, two detectors at another baseline, 7,500 kilometers, or one detector at 7,500 kilometer and one detector at 3,000 kilometers. So this is their favored scenario. And the way to read these plots, they show the sensitivity for sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi, the thing that we were looking at just a moment ago, determining the sine of delta m squared and CP violation. So what's the minimum value of sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi for which you could do these things? And these black bars give you the answer. And the gray areas show you how the answer would vary as you vary delta m squared 2,1 within the current favored region. So you could be anywhere within this black bar. And you see, for their favored scenario, the full physics program can be accomplished at around or perhaps a little bit below 10 to the minus 4 in sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi. Sorry? Well, it's just their way of stressing that they've conserved the total detector mass. So these scenarios don't have half the mass of that scenario. That's just their notation. So you could use two baselines. There are other strategies, and in fact, the Spanish group here have looked at combining how well you would do if you just combine one baseline neutrino factory around 3,000 kilometers with a superbeam experiment with a much shorter baseline. And the way they present their results, they show in this phi to 1 phi versus delta CP space, the precision that you can expect for the measurement, so the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours, and they've considered various values of delta from zero, so CP conserving, maximally CP violating, or CP conserving here again, and for two different values of phi to 1 phi. So this is a value of phi to 1 phi which is fairly small, 4 times 10 to the minus 4 for sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi, and this is a value in the where superbeam experiments would have a lot of fun. So this is a value of sine squared 2 phi to 1 phi of 0.08. So if you look at the very small value, then you look at the, try to read off the plus or minus one sigma sensitivity for delta CP, you find it's around 20 degrees, which means that this is really the limiting sensitivity for just using this strategy, because plus or minus 20 degrees, after all, is only a few sigma observation of maximal CP violation. So you could see a first observation of CP at this level. And here you do a factor of a few better than that by combining one superbeam experiment at one superbeam baseline and one neutrino factory baseline. Another strategy is to exploit nu e to nu tau channel at a neutrino factory, and these are similar ellipses. And if one looks, for example, at sine squared 2 theta 1 3 of 1 times 10 to the minus 3, then you get a sigma for delta CP at plus or minus 15 degrees. So this is another very useful strategy for getting rid of the correlations and ambiguities and beginning to get reasonable precision for these measurements. So unfortunately, no one yet has combined all of these strategies to see how well you might ultimately do. However, looking at what's already been done, it seems fairly safe to conclude that one can execute the whole program at a neutrino factory if sine squared 2 theta 1 3 exceeds about of order 10 to the minus 4. And if it turns out that free flavor mixing is the whole story, so LS and D is not confirmed and there's nothing else going on, and if sine squared 2 theta 1 3 in addition is not far below the current bound, and if CP violation is maximal, we're in the scenario where superbeams might see a first observation for CP violation, then it looks as if the program at a neutrino factory would be to consolidate that observation and improve the measurements, the precision of the measurements, by at least a factor of a few, and hopefully much better than that, although one needs to do the work of including all of the information to see how well one could really do. So one can then ask, as a function of what might happen in the future, what's the program of physics at a neutrino factory? So this is supposed to be a summary of that. So there are a number of different possibilities. And then in the middle column, there's what you might expect or hope a superbeam would accomplish. And then these would then be the goals for a neutrino factory. So the most exciting of the possibilities would be if free flavor mixing is not the whole story. There's something else going on. Maybe LSND is confirmed, or maybe some other effects are seen. Then what's likely to be the main outcome of superbeam experiments would be to hope, the nicest thing would be to establish confusion in the nicest possible sense, in that we now have an embarrassment of riches, in that we know that other things are going on in addition to free flavor mixing, and then we have to try to sort it out. And in that nice situation, then clearly the goal of a neutrino factory is to try to sort out what's going on and measure parameters. If life is more mundane and free flavor mixing really is the whole story, then the program will depend on whether sine squared 2 theta 1 3 is largish or very small, smaller than 0.01, for example. And it will depend on whether delta CP is CP violation is maximal or much smaller than maximal. And you notice that in all of these scenarios, measuring CP violation is part of the neutrino factory program. In all but the last scenario here, searching for CP violation is part of the program. So in the last scenario, that's the superbeam happy scenario, where you might see a first observation, and then the neutrino factory would then give you the main course after this appetizer of seeing CP violation of a few sigma. Now, this is just a very brief reminder that, in fact, should it be that we're in the scenario where free flavor mixing is not the whole story, it could well be that we can get away with a far less ambitious neutrino factory than the salt that we've been talking about. And this is just to illustrate this, just one example for one particular model, which predicts as a function of some one CP, one of the CP phases, the rate at which you would see nu e to nu tau interactions, these red curves, as a function of the baseline, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 kilometers, for a detector which was only 1 kiloton detector in 6 months of running at a high-performance neutrino factory. You notice these rates go up to 10 to the 4. So maybe you can get away with a factor of 100 less intensity, or even a factor of 1,000 less intensity, and still start the physics. So we should bear in mind that should we be lucky enough that that there's more going on than free flavor mixing, then maybe there's a way that we can start a neutrino factory program earlier and cheaper than would otherwise be the case. So far, everything I said has been motivated by the desire to understand neutrino oscillations, but one should remember that at a neutrino factory, near to the neutrino factory, there are 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 events per kilogram per year for a 50 GeV neutrino factory. So there's a lot of other physics you can think of doing, and the list is longer than the list written here, but clearly there are precise cross-section measurements, structure functions, precise alpha-rest measurements, study of nuclear effects, spin structure functions, single-tag charm mesons and baryons. In a one-ton detector, there's a 10 to the 8 flavor-tag charm hadrons per year, for example, electroweak tests, exotic interactions, neutral heavy electrons, anomalous neutrinos, interactions in electromagnetic fields, etc. And I was asked a few weeks ago to try to estimate how many physicists might actually be engaged in the neutrino factory community, which is something which is an amusing exercise to contemplate. And if you think about it, you would probably have two long baseline experiments, possibly a continuation of a superbeam experiment. Out of this long list of neutrino interaction experiments, maybe there's three out of the list that you might be executing. At the accelerator complex, you also have very intense proton beams and very intense muon beams. So you could imagine a continuation of experiments with kaons or muons or even neutrons, maybe a couple of experiments like that. And then the accelerator R&D community working towards a muon collider or other parts of this technology, you could also expect some activity. And you can quickly, easily get 1,000 scientists working at this facility. Okay, so I probably don't have time to say much about the R&D. How much do I have so I can gauge?
3 months.
Okay, so first thing to say about the R&D is that technically there's been a tremendous amount of progress in the last couple of years. And just to illustrate that, one can show a picture gallery of the hardware R&D that's going on. And there's one, page one. And here's page two. And there are other pages that I don't have transparencies of here. And it would be a whole talk in itself just to talk about the hardware R&D and the results and the progress that's been made. Every year we have an annual technical review, an external technical review of the work of the 130 scientists that are working on neutrino factory R&D. And out of this, the last two reports and the last two reviews have been glowing. So they recognize the progress that's being made. But out of this, two critical items have been identified. There's a muon ionization cooling demonstration experiment which needs to be executed. So this is the new technique, so we need to demonstrate that. And we need to get to a feasibility study three. Remember, we had two studies, but the studies we had so far have been focused on performance and not on cost. So the work that's going on now is now focused on bringing the cost down, and we think in a couple of years' time we'll be ready for a study three to make a cost-effective study. So just a few words on the cooling experiment. So our external technical review said the cooling demonstration is the key systems test for a neutrino factory. So we put together a strong international collaboration, the US, Europe, and Japan. And a year ago, we have an experimental concept where there's a chunk of a cooling channel, there's some instrumentation before and after to measure very precisely muon by muon going through this cooling channel, so you can measure the response of the muons to the cooling channel. So we put a proposal together, we submitted an LOI to the Rutherford Lab in the UK a year ago. That received a favorable review. They encouraged us to proceed to a full proposal, and they put in place a project team to make sure we succeeded in developing a full proposal. That proposal was submitted a few weeks ago and has just been reviewed by a committee, and we've just, in fact, this is a little bit out of date, just while we're here this week, we got the first draft of the report from the committee, which begins by encouraging the collaboration to proceed to seek funding. So we think we've got a good design, the support of a laboratory, and now we move on to the next and challenging step, which Boris knows very well about, trying to get this thing funded. So that's called the mice experiment, for muon ionization cooling experiment. Okay, and I have no minutes left, and in no minutes let me just say that study free, cost reduction. If we look at the cost of the neutrino factory design we had in study two, roughly it's divided into four equal pieces. There's this phase rotation piece, the cooling, the acceleration, and everything else. So we've been working on the three pieces we can attack. Everything else is a mush of things, so it's hard to attack that. But the three quarters of the cost, those three other things, we've been attacking. And for every single one of these three things, we have now concepts which we're developing which we think will significantly reduce the cost. For example, there's this phase rotation, which is roughly a quarter of the cost. It used to be a 328 meter long system with a lot of acceleration and a very difficult technology. It's now 166 meters long with much less acceleration and a much cheaper technology, and here are some of the factors. That doesn't necessarily mean the cost will come down by this factor, but it does give you a feeling that the cost reduction we're hoping for will be a significant one. Then for the cooling channel, you have similar factors, the old concept, the new concept is a little ring for a cooling channel, less aggressive parameters, much more compact. And for the acceleration, the story is similar, we have a new concept for the acceleration. Used to be a lot of a long accelerating length, it's now only 35% of that, with a much lower gradient, and the possibility of having a more cost-effective solution. And we think in 2 years' time we'll be ready for the engineering task, the study three. So let me summarize. So neutrino factories, we think, have the right characteristics to do the job, so they have all these good things going for them. And we think that they could execute the full oscillation program probably down to sine squared 2 phi to 1 free of order 10 to the minus 4. If it turns out that sine squared 2 phi to 1 free is not far below the current limit and everything else is good, like CP is maximal, violation is maximal, and there's no other complications from LS&D being confirmed and so on and so forth, then the program would be to consolidate the measurements and turn them from first observations into precision measurements. And the work that's been done so far suggests that you improve the precision by at least a factor of a few. And we'd hope that this would be a much larger factor once we've understood what happens when you throw all the information. And finally, it's important to note that the R&D that's ongoing is only being done because it has the support of the neutrino community. And for it to continue and bring it to a successful conclusion, the support of the community is extremely important, because in the current budget situation, these things are vulnerable. And let me just note that once a year we have new fact workshops where we discuss neutrino factories and superbeams, incidentally. So the scope of the meeting is neutrino factories and superbeams. And this year it's at Columbia University, June the 5th to the 11th. And I think there's been a lot of progress since the last year, and there's obviously a lot of evolution in our understanding of the experiment capabilities and so on. So I hope many of you will attend, I hope, that meeting. Thank you.
Can you show that summary graph where you plot the ratio of neutrino burns in the baseline?
I'm not sure which of the summary graphs. The ones with the bars? Oh, okay, yes. That was more an illustrative graph than a summary graph, but yes.
From that graph, it looks as though the long baseline. My question is, how do you choose the baseline?
Well, that's the detailed question for which you need all these, to understand the impact of correlations, uncertainties, and these complicated fitting programs. The set of baselines that you would need, and the set of the optimum set of experiments that you need, is still something that's very much being explored at the moment. So this, looking at this graph and trying to interpret, one can do that, and we did do that in the early days. But the results aren't necessary. The results can be misleading, so I won't try to do that here. You really have to look at the full fits and really understand. One strategy is to have two different baselines, right? One baseline where you're dominated by CP effects, and the other baseline where you're dominated by matter effects. That's one strategy.